Why is that? And his answer was, I'm just the kind of guy who rolls sixes.
He's a winner. Did you hire him?
No. For an analytics team, this is a terrible answer. We made fun of this guy internally. The team considered this to be the all-time worst answer to this question. It was so bad. With more experience, I have come to understand that this is actually an all-time great answer to this question, just not for the analytics team. Send that guy to the sales team.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we learn from executives and founders that are changing their companies and changing industries about what they uniquely see that others don't when it comes to top talent. If this is your first episode, welcome aboard. If you've been a longtime listener, we appreciate your support. Either way, please make sure to subscribe and give us a great rating. Today, we have an excellent guest. I'm very excited for this conversation. Today, we're joined by Derek Steer. He is the CEO at Superframe, former CEO at Mode. Derek, how the heck are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Oz. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. We were just talking a little bit earlier about go-to-market and kind of some of the same things that we're going through. I am super pumped about this conversation for that reason. I feel like there's a lot I'm going to learn, and I just can't wait to dig into it. But let's start here. Let's start at the highest level. You're the founder and CEO of Superframe, which I brought up a minute ago. Can you tell us a little bit about the company and what your vision for the org is?
Yeah, so Superframe is brand new. We are a very small team today, but have a pretty good vision toward building the enterprise CRM that sales and RevOps teams really want. So, you know, no secret that Salesforce is the most popular thing in this space right now, largely because it's the most configurable and customizable. So even once you get past a small handful of salespeople, you have this need to tailor your systems to be able to run exactly the process that you want. That's what the market has wanted now. They want to integrate with everything else in their stack, and they want it to run whatever process they imagine. But actually tailoring it to run that process is awful. It's terrible. And we really started this company to try and solve that problem first. And in doing so, we came across a lot of other things that can be improved. I mean, Salesforce is, you know, 20 plus year old software at this point. So there are lots of things about the way that people interact with it directly that can be different. The feature set that is easier for us to build today, especially in the era of AI, than, you know, what they could do back then. But in particular, the thing that we are trying to do is give people the ability to have really accurate forecasts, really custom data models, really clean data, all of the stuff that people look for in their CRM at scale, but with none of the headache associated with like typical maintenance.
When you say the configuration, is it just easier to do with Superframe, or is it that you're putting some best practices in place that you want to have more rigidity or some combination of those things?
Well, it is fundamentally easier. So there are some behind the scenes things that we have done with the way that you configure the system, your ability to see how things are configured. So a kind of classic problem is, you know, most folks who adopt Salesforce, they expect to have someone whose job it is to maintain it, at least one person. And when you get up to big mega scale, you know, you're talking about public companies, you're now in the realm of like a 50 person team just to manage Salesforce. And that's like all kinds of stuff, right? It is, you know, integrating other tools. It is making sure that you don't have a bunch of duplicate data. It is making sure that people enter data properly into the system. There's just a lot of manual work that's required there. It doesn't have to all be manual. Like, a lot of this stuff can be taken over by AI. And in particular, I think there's some of it that's really well suited for that. So the problem, if you were to talk to someone who works in Salesforce, who administers it, one of the biggest problems for them is they know exactly what they want to change at a given time, but it might take a week of research to figure out, if I make this change, what else will I break? What will I have to fix? What else will I have to change? So we started really with that kind of problem first and said, okay, well, we think that AI is really well suited to solve that kind of problem, because it can be trained to understand, you know, what a good system should look like or what a correct configuration should look like given a certain prompt, and it has access to all of the configuration. It can essentially do the research instantly. We actually started this business trying to do that on top of Salesforce, and we got so frustrated in doing it and realized that it was never going to be possible on Salesforce, and so decided to build our own CRM as a result. But there are those technical reasons where we've instead built a system that the way that it is configured is going to allow us to make it much more scalable and be able to solve those kinds of problems much faster than you would with Salesforce, so that when you are running this thing, you know, let's even take like a friend of mine who runs a 500 person company and spends roughly $500,000 a year on Salesforce, and then has a team of like five people, which he considers to be a small team at that scale, working on Salesforce. We should be able to cut that cost by a quarter and have everything else happen much faster, right? Like, it's going to be a pretty dramatic shift in what revenue organizations, not only how much they spend, but what they can do with their systems and how quickly they can change to adapt as they need to change their sales processes.
Yeah, what's interesting is that Mark Benioff, the founder of Salesforce, I think I saw it was his first LinkedIn post a couple of days ago. You might have seen it. And it was around talking about AI and what AI is doing with Salesforce and all the different use cases and capabilities they have there. I have to imagine that there's like some advantage to be building your product core in this time that we're in right now from an artificial intelligence perspective. I know in my own personal software journey that I thought when we first started building this out that my AI roadmap was down the road and that it was going to be super costly and that we would eventually get there. But then as we were building, obviously the democratization of AI with everything we've seen with Claude and OpenAI and ChatGPT and all that good stuff, it's become so native to our product and intrinsic into our product. And I feel like there's been a difference with there. Do you see something similar in terms of the timing of when you're building this? Do you see an advantage in that?
Yeah, I'll give you a real concrete example. So one of the things that Superframe does that no other CRM does, to my knowledge, is that we keep a complete history of absolutely every single thing that happens. So imagining yourself as a Salesforce customer, Oz, you wanted to go in and look and see, hey, we're engaged in a deal with some company. Deloitte. Okay, let's say it's Deloitte. And so you go into the record on Deloitte and you want to know, hey, I see someone filled out. They said that that they think the close date for this deal is going to be next month. I wonder how accurate that is. Okay. So if you want to understand who populated that or when they got updated, there's no information in Salesforce to tell you that. All you might know is, oh, Derek is the last person who edited this record, and he edited on this date. But you don't know what I edited. You don't know what the previous values were. Like, you don't even know which field I changed, let alone what the previous value was. You can see, obviously, the latest values for everything, but that's it.
Sure.
And that sort of information in lots of places is really important. So, you know, I think many people in this world think that the obvious job for AI is to auto-populate fields in the CRM for you, or to do away with the need for fields at all. Right? But people view the role of AI here as this is going to take away from manual data entry that takes a lot of time for people and is very frustrating.
Yeah, listen, that makes a lot of sense to me as a leader. If I'm looking at something and I'm wondering how it got there, why it got there, it might be super impactful. It might be the difference between, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars or not. Having that level of nuance and detail to be able to get into that level and drill down, for me personally, would have saved me time and make sure that I'm addressing the right problem, right? So I think that's a really, really smart use case right there. One of the things that really stands out to me about what you're doing is you're going into right into enterprise, you're going into CRM. There is a obvious like big behemoth in this space that's sucking up a lot of the market share. Not many founders are saying, I want to go pick a fight with the biggest bully on the block. Why to be an insurgent in such a competitive space, and how do you plan to really stand out or sell against Salesforce?
Well, so as I mentioned, I didn't start out making a product that competed directly in Salesforce. We were trying to build on top of it to solve this exact problem. And then we realized, we still believe this is the most important problem in CRM at the moment, and we realized that we weren't going to be able to solve it unless we built our own CRM. And so as a team, we sat down and said, okay, let's start with the assumption that we are going to build a CRM and then try to find a path to success. And I think we found one that is more than just a little bit viable. In fact, it's one I'm very confident in. I'm not really a stranger to competitive spaces. My last company, Mode, was in business intelligence. And we managed to break out by serving a particular niche audience, which was the technical analyst and data scientist. We did really well there. We have big customers who are paying us millions of dollars a year and ultimately sold that company for hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, it's certainly possible to be successful in these spaces. The big lesson, I would say, is that, like, I would say two. So one is finding sub audiences in these big horizontal markets. Like, if you look at a lot of, you know, startup CRM websites, they have pretty vague messaging, Because I think there's this natural trend to not want to turn a customer away, right? There are a lot of folks who just don't ever want to turn away someone who's willing to pay them money, especially as a startup that, like, you know, loses money, really basically overinvests in product development and is not profitable. And I think that's just a real failure mode. And this is something that, a lot of, you know, second, third time founders I talk to really see clearly and agree with me on is the more you constrain your audience, the easier it is to solve their problem, the better job you can do of solving it, the more you can message to them and attract them. So for us, part of this is that we're going to market, even though our product is the most flexible thing in the market, more flexible even than Salesforce, we can solve anyone's CRM need, but we have chosen to ignore everyone except for B2B software as a service companies in North America in the 5 to 10 salesperson range. That is our initial market. And we know that those companies are consistent enough in the products that they want to integrate, that we're not going to have to build tons and tons of integrations. We can build a few and do them really well and cover a lot of our market. And we can build standard reporting and a standard data model. Like, we can provide a lot to our customers very quickly by focusing on this super narrow audience, such that our value prop relative to a Salesforce is going to be like, hey, you know you're going to have to migrate to an advanced CRM in order to scale, in order to get the types of processes that you want to run, in order to integrate with the things you want to integrate with, and you probably think Salesforce is the only answer. SuperFrame can do it too, but if you go with SuperFrame instead of Salesforce, you're not going to have to do a six-month rollout with a consultant. You're going to have this thing set up for you next week, not just the basic data model and having your data in there, but you're going to have a full suite of reporting that you can use to run your deal reviews and your board meetings and everything else. And providing that level of service, that kind of time to value and that kind of result in such a short time is not possible unless we just narrow our focus a ton. So, you know, while it looks like, oh, we compete against this behemoth, what we've chosen to do is compete against the company that this current market, like the sub-market that we care about, largely views as archaic and, you know, the devil they know, or the thing that they are stuck with, right? So they have a negative sentiment already. And we know that we can over-deliver for them as long as we do the specific things they care about.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. A great product leader I know was telling me that the best process when you're going to market is be, just as you talked about, super hyper-focused. So let's say that you're selling, you know, umbrellas, right? You're going into a market of 25 to 35-year-old females of Japanese descent with two kids who live in the specific region who go to this specific store every day. And if you can get that very, very hyper-focused target market to buy 10 times out of 10, now you start to widen your aperture and start to look at the different types of ways you can grow from there. Now we're opening it up to 50-year-old, and then we're opening to male and female, and you go from there. And so that's a very, very smart way to get off the floor, but also really learn your product and learn who loves your product, because ultimately those first adopters are the ones that really drive for you as an evangelist, and you learn so much from that, kind of set the target for the product going forward. So I think that that's really smart. Another thing that we talked about is that SaaS, you know, you hear a lot of companies there, they're building vertically, and you've decided to zig when others are zagging by building horizontally. I want to understand, can you explain the difference for people who might not know what those two different approaches mean? And then tell us why that strategy makes sense for SuperFrame.
So it's a lot of what I just said. The horizontal means it's a thing that you can market to everybody. So a great example of a horizontal product is Google Docs. Every industry, you know, people write documents. Excel is another horizontal product, which means that Airtable and Notion are also horizontal products. The benefit to them is that the markets are absolutely enormous. The downside in some cases, right? So, like, especially you take a product like Notion, many of the people who use Notion you never ever have any contact with. Similar to Dropbox, right? Dropbox has many, many, many users who never interact with a human being that works at Dropbox. The benefit to that also is you can run things like freemium models like Dropbox does, right? Where you start using it for free just to get a huge audience, and then, you know, that way instead of selling to people you don't know, you're selling to people who already use the product. So there are things about that that can be really good. It's very market dependent. So I'll use a great example from my last company, Mode. Mode had to be connected to companies' data warehouses. And often the person who was our core user or buyer, they didn't necessarily have access to provision us on top of their data warehouse on their own. So we kind of had to hold their hands in some cases, right? And the bigger the company got, the more we were selling to companies that were bigger, had more process, more bureaucracy. And so there was just no chance that they were going to be able to connect it to the database entirely on their own with no help from us. And so we had to go in and help out. Those cases where you need to be a little bit more handheld or where, you know, there's going to be a higher cost of acquisition, those are cases where you might be able to lower that cost of acquisition by verticalizing, right? So verticalizing essentially is, which really means picking a sub audience. So it could be an industry specific sub audience. It could be a persona that you pick. By doing that, you are making it easier to tell a story that is going to attract more customers. Like for us in the B2B SaaS world, like on our website, we make it very clear that we are for B2B SaaS companies. Even though our product can support anybody, we have decided to make that explicitly clear. Because look, CRM, it is difficult to understand differentiation right when you get to our website. It is difficult in this, because it's such a crowded market, it's difficult to understand who you should even look at, let alone what is different from product A to product B. And one way for us to tell our story about how we're different is not just to tell about what features are different or what problem we solve, but it's to tell you who we're for. And that can be an attractive way to go bring people in. Because if we're marketing to a B2B SaaS company, they might not understand anything else that's on their website, but if they see this is the CRM for B2B SaaS, it's probably worth at least having a call to understand why we're better for them specifically than Salesforce might be.
That makes total sense. One of the conversations that I've had with a lot of founders I know and different businesses is it feels like everybody is trying to get less out of more, right? We're trying to kind of lean out our organizations, make sure we're optimal, make sure that we're doing more with the resources we have and figuring out how we can do it even better. It seems like a more profound theme than I've ever heard in any time in history. Now, so I would naturally start to correlate this with AI, right? People are thinking AI can 10x my productivity, 5x my productivity in this space, and thus I don't need as many resources. But you and I were talking, you mentioned it's not always the way AI is impacting it in the way that people would commonly think, like I just said. So I'm just interested to know, can you talk about the plan, how you're going to build your team for Superframe and the strategy? Are you going to have a big bloated organization with tons of developers, engineers, sales, and all that? Or how are you looking at your approach as you build this company from ground up?
Yeah. So the first thing is we need to essentially act like a prototype for our customers. We know that our future customers are going to want to produce as much revenue with the lowest headcount possible, of course. And people have an idea that they can now. You know, it remains to be seen how effective AI is and at what stages in the pipeline, right? Like, there is not good information yet. We've not heard a lot of big success stories, okay? But people believe that it's possible, and so we need to at least do our best to make that a reality ourselves, and then enable our customers to make that a reality. So there are two pieces. One is how we develop our software, which we use AI extensively, co-pilots, that kind of thing, especially for writing testing and software. You know, any software developer listening to this is going to be familiar with this already.
Yeah, I want to drill down with you right there real quick. Sure. So when we talk about the productivity gains for a developer, is it a matter of predictive language build out for developers, and that's how they get the productivity? How are developers particularly getting AI to make them more productive and get a bigger output?
So for the folks who are listening who are not familiar with testing, I'll give an example here that's not exactly what developers do, but it's kind of in the same realm. So at Superframe, we are the CRM software. People put in lots of information. They put in how big they think deals will be in dollars or some other currency, when the close date will be, who's going to be involved in the deal. And there are maybe 20 different types of data that we support. We support currency. We support, free text. We support dates. And we have a little date picker for that. We have lots of different things. We need to check to make sure that when a date gets entered, it's actually a date. Right, there's validation required. And under the hood, in any software, there is a need to have this type of validation when one system passes data to another system, for example. And when lots of engineers work in the same code base, these tests are really important because if I'm working over here in part A and I tweak something that maybe breaks part B, the people working on part B, if things are functioning properly, they've set up tests that will fail when I break it, right? So if I'm over in A, I can just work freely knowing that if I do something that breaks part B, it's going to raise an alarm on one of these tests, and then it's going to let me know, and I can know that I need to fix what I've done. That's maybe the best I can do without getting too deep into the weeds.
No, listen, that was a wonderful explanation. And it's like everybody, I work with this with my development team. We're finding out ways that we can kind of supercharge our team and get less out of more and be more productive and 5x, 10x. And I was looking at a lot of the coding, but you just explained that wonderfully. I think that's going to help people understand and put in their mind. Now, I stopped you midstream. You were talking about, getting productivity out of your developers. What other parts of the organization?
Well, I was going to say, to cap that off, writing these tests is a pain. No one likes doing it. It's not, once you build the feature, the test is like an extra thing that you have to do. You've already like shipped the value to the customer in theory. The test is something you do so that no one breaks your feature in the future or to make sure that you've kind of covered all the edge cases. And it's annoying to do, but it turns out these co-pilots are really, really good at doing it for you. And I'm sure everyone has at some point had this experience of like, you just don't want to do the work. Like even if it isn't that slow to do, it is made slower because of how little you want to do it. And so co-pilots, I think, are helpful that they step in moments where people would otherwise be really bored and not want to do the work. As far as other parts of the organization, I don't think I can say anything new about summarization of call transcripts and email drafting and those sorts of things. People know generally, what AI can do for you in communication. What I would say is I think that we are the first products that people started to make in this world that seem to have gotten a bit of traction is this notion of an AI SDR, sales development rep, which is effectively AI to go and figure out who you should sell to and then write them emails and, funnel them to the right person when there is a response. But it is the first touch point. And really, when you talk to people who've used these, they'll tell you it's like spray and pray, right? So it just reaches out to way more people than a regular human might in a much less targeted way. The response rates are atrocious. And I have yet to hear of folks who are really reliably closing lots of business based on this. Hmm. I think a better way to do this is to try and fold what AI does well into other strategies that might yield a higher response rate. So introductions, I think, is a really good one, right? How can we get through warm introductions to the people we want to sell to? Can we use AI to do that more effectively? I'm very intrigued by that.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
So, Derek, let's talk about hiring now, because you're somebody that has built, one really successful organization in Mode. You're in the process of trying to do the same thing with Superframe. Talent is obviously really important. We talked about the generalist versus the specialist and the need to have the right type of fit within your organization. Let's start with this question first. Do you have a core hiring philosophy when it comes to the type of talent that you want to bring in the door to work with you and work with your team?
I have a few. When it comes to like the individuals, I will tell you I have more of a bias than a philosophy, which is a question you might have been waiting to ask me later, but I'll give it to you now. Which is, I really like people who can explain trade-offs. And I tend to look for this in interview processes. I will also say that this is very role dependent. So I find that engineers and data analysts and kind of like operational folks, they tend to be, the good ones tend to be good at this, which is, hey, explain to me why you made decision A instead of decision B in this particular spot. And they can run down all of the different things that factored into the decision and why they ultimately picked one. I have found that this is not the case with salespeople in particular. And it turns out that, you know, there is some amount of intuition that goes into what they do, depending on, you know, the type of business and how they've been selling. But I also just find that in terms of like the skills that they've built up, they've just spent less time, you know, articulating their process to other people. And so they're worse at it. And so like hiring sales leaders was a thing that I don't know if I'm good at it yet, to be perfectly honest. I don't think I have a formula for it, but I can tell you that it's more difficult for me because of this particular thing. And when people are good or bad, I'm very good at evaluating whether someone is good or bad at explaining, you know, what they've done and why. And I at least just know, you know, I have limitations. I don't think that really gets to your philosophy question, but in terms of what guides me, that probably guides me more than anything else.
Yeah, you made me think of something. So like when hiring salespeople is a beast unto itself. But I got to imagine, I don't know who your persona is for Superframe, but I have to imagine chief commercial officer or somebody leading a sales organization. Is it different to hire salespeople selling to other salespeople? Like, do you have to think about that when you're identifying that and qualifying that talent? Or is it pretty much the same as somebody selling to procurement or HR or whatever it may be?
I suspect that the answer is yes, but that would be my default almost whatever, of, you know, like is a specialist going to do a better job than a specialist in a different thing? Like, all basically always yes. You know, that said, I'm not entirely sure that the salesperson is the primary persona to whom we will sell anyway. I do understand that heads of sales are buyers for CRM products. And so in that sense, like, we absolutely have to win over heads of sales. But in terms of our differentiation, the people who are closest to the problem are actually in revenue operations or sales operations, right? And I think there is one potential strategy where we, rather than trying to break through everyone who is selling this thing to heads of sales, that we say, hey, we are the thing, we have spent more time thinking about revenue operations and the maintenance of these systems than any other CRM company. I am confident that we spend more time thinking about that audience than anyone else in this space, and certainly more than Salesforce. I think Salesforce, like, treats them very poorly. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the answer is, actually, we're hiring someone to do that instead. So the biggest challenge as a startup is actually not whether I want to specialize around salespeople or not. It's how do I find someone who's going to help figure out what the most effective pathway is for us, whether it is through RevOps in the side door to the sales leader or to the sales leader directly.
Well, that's the exciting part about being in the startup. I mean, you're figuring it out, you're working, you're having to build that persona, you're having to test things, you're having to see what comes back. And it's almost like when you hit that eureka moment, when you get that, whether it be product market fit or you realize that you're starting to get repetition in terms of consistently good results, that's such an exciting thing. And I would think that's a very compelling and exciting reason to come work at a startup like Superframe. So anybody in sales who's interested in listening, please hit up Derek. What about engineers? Is there like a behavioral quality when you're looking at a lead engineer that really stands out to you? Like, is there something that, like, when you're interviewing them, I want them to have this characteristic or this character trait? Anything come to mind when I ask you that?
So at Mode, I used to do these follow-ups. Typically, especially once we got into, like, you know, a couple hundred employees, I didn't have a chance to, like, really sit down with everyone one-on-one. The main touch points I would have with new employees was I would do a little bit of onboarding right at the beginning. You know, I would come in your first or second day and you would get the kind of vision talk from me, which I think is very important. And then I would show up 30 days later for a one-on-one. And I did these one-on-ones with pretty much everybody. There's a small window when one of my co-founders did them, but otherwise we were always doing these one-on-ones. And at 30 days, engineers in particular would say to me one of two things. They would either say, wow, it's been so nice. Like, I've had like a time to ramp and kind of get my footing and everything. And then there were other engineers who would say, I thought I would have gotten more done. And I'll tell you, I mean, like, look, both of these things lead to a problem, which is that we were relatively slow in getting engineers to productivity. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. We had a very complicated set of systems that was difficult to set up and get people running on, you know, partially because of the product and partially because of decisions that we had made. That aside, there's a big attitude difference between I thought I was going to get more done and I was so happy with, like, you know, the chill pace at which we started.
And you're absolutely looking for the person who wants to have gotten more done, obviously.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Every time I heard, I'm like happy about the chill pace. I made a mental note and I like looked back a couple months later and it was just 1-to-1. Like those were not the most effective people. So more than anything, it's attitude. Now, if you were to talk to my co-founder and CTO, Nick, he would have a totally different thing to say about evaluating engineers. He cares very much about technical acumen and making good trade-offs within a code base, but you know, those things go together. And he agrees with me, by the way, on this attitude thing.
Yeah, listen, it's interesting, and I wouldn't say that I adhere to this whatsoever, but it's a mental model that I heard about 6 to 8 months ago that's kind of resonated in my head. And it said, especially in a startup environment, when you hire somebody and you go 30 days in, and you know everything you know now, that 30 days then, if they are not still a hell yeah hire right off the bat, then you probably should let them go right away. And I just think that's a very interesting thing because to the point we made earlier, especially with sales, sometimes you don't know what you're getting in the interview. You know, I'm creating software, our services company combats this and tries to make it so that we truly understand the person before you offer them so you know what you're getting. You have that better predictive success metric. But ultimately, it's still a very hard thing to do to understand when you get 3 or 4 interviews with somebody who they're going to be. But 30 days in, that's a pretty good litmus test. And if you're feeling a little bit of buyer's remorse or I'm not sure that this was the right person, the model I read was that you should just let them go right away. And it's not a bad thing. It's a, hey, listen, this isn't the right fit because otherwise you're going to deal with so much lack of productivity and having to work through those things and eventually make that decision that it's better just to cut right then. And it's so funny because I read that right before I hired a chief revenue officer that I was super excited about. And I remember I put a calendar note, like, all right, I'm going to check 30 days later because I'm feeling so good about this hire right now. And I put a note on the calendar, forgot about it, popped up on my calendar 30 days later. And I thought, I'm feeling really good. This is a good hire. I don't know if I would have done anything anyway, but that was like a model for me that's good. And it's one I think about now because you want to be getting more 30 days later. That it doesn't happen that often, but if you're really good at hiring and interviewing, you can identify those things where you're getting more than you bought when you interviewed. And that, like I said, it's not that common. So I find that interesting, that chill mode. And like you said, you know, you keep that mental note in your head and then you come to find out that the success rate of that person versus the other is a completely different thing. So,
you know, before this, I was listening to your episode with Abigail Phillips. And in there,
she's
you...
She's amazing, by the way.
You made no secret of what a fan you were. And it sounds like you have similar philosophies. And so what I'm about to say, I think will resonate with you very much. You made an analogy that I think was like a Premier League analogy. I'll make the basketball version, which is I'm, you know, born and raised in San Francisco, big Golden State Warriors fan. We lost one of our stars, Klay Thompson, over the summer, but we got Buddy Hield, who is a great 3-point shooter, but has had an okay career to date and is now having, at least as of, you know, mid-November when we're having this conversation, he's having a career season because he's in a system that is perfect for his style of play. And he's replacing someone who did effectively the same job, shooting lots of threes on the move. And so he's very, very successful. And that degree of fit matters, right? It's not like Buddy Hield became a much better basketball player over the summer. He's been in the league for like a decade, I think. It's really just that he's found the fit that makes him most effective. And so, you know, for me, the other kind of thing that guides how I hire came from executive hiring. So, you know, when I hired my first couple execs back in Mode, the amount of effort that goes into exec hiring is immense. And effectively what I did was I wrote out their OKRs before hiring any or even going to interview people, right? It was like, okay, exactly what do we want people to accomplish? What do we think that's going to look like? You know, what is the sort of, you know, boundary for creativity here versus what we just like want people to do? There are all kinds of questions that we answered. And then we went out to find, you know, folks who met that very specifically. And for the most part were, you know, successful. And then, you know, when that really lines up, that's when you at 30 days go, okay, yeah, this is like the right kind of person. I've tried to apply as much of that as possible to hiring in any role, because that is how you engineer fit, right? Like, especially the challenge with hiring generalists, as I've said, we want to do at the moment. Yeah, we want generalists, but we also want to figure out, you know, are those generalists going to be aligned with the stuff that we need to do at the moment? So it might be as simple as we want generalists who are a little more leaning toward back-end systems than front-end because we have a particularly complex back-end, right? Whereas, you know, if I were doing the same thing for Mode, in a lot of ways, it was the opposite. Mode's front end was extremely complex. So even just those subtle differences and looking at like what projects are people going to work on and, you know, how are they going to work in teams with the other people here, those inform who might be the best fit. Whether we are going to be the organization that maximizes their talents, I think is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, so there's a couple of threads I'm going to pull on here. So the first one is that I genuinely believe that we as a society, as people, over-index to this idea of individual talent that's just a rock star that solves every problem and fits in every situation and is dynamite. You know, we'll look at like Tom Brady. He could have gotten drafted by anybody and he would have been as successful as he was, or Ben Roethlisberger. And I just find that not to be the case. I actually think that there are those rare and unique, what I call A players. You drop them into any situation, they're going to figure it out. They're going to be successful. But they're so few and far between. The vast majority of people, going back to your Buddy Hield analogy, are if you get the right system for them, you find them at the right time of where they're at in their career and what they need to do and what they excel at, and then you help them lean into that, that's when you can get way better results than they might have ever gotten in the past. The second thread I'm going to pull on here, and we're definitely going to turn into the Zach Lowe Hoop Collective podcast right now. You walked into my space of the NBA, is I totally agree with your analogy. Like you said, it's only about 8 games in. Warriors are playing really well. They're only behind my favorite team, the Phoenix Suns, in terms of the Western Conference playoffs.
They're tied today. It's November 7th, and both teams are 7-1.
And you just did record. Beat the Celtics in Boston last night, so I got to give you credit. And Buddy Hield did hit a really big three at the end of the game to get it to where it was. And so I just totally agree with you. Like, Clay, as much as there was a lot of emotion, and this is another business lesson that we all learn, right? Your company grows. What got you here won't get you there. There's a lot of emotion tied to a guy like Klay Thompson, but the Warriors smartly assessed and said, it's better for both sides for Klay to move on and for us to figure out what we can do to take this next phase as a team to build around Steph and to win. And I just think it's fantastic that they took Buddy Hield, to your point, plugged him in. He's playing that Klay role at a better level, right? That right now, because he's younger and a little bit faster and his shot is amazing. But also, I really like what you've done in terms of building around depth from like 1 to 10 on that team, which is another lesson that we can take in business in terms of having a bunch of quality players who know their role and play them well. And that's very different than when you had our shared friend Kevin Durant on your team and you had the lineup of death and you had all these superstars, right? But not much depth behind that. So it's just interesting to watch organizations morph and change. And I just really loved your analogy. And anytime I get a chance to talk NBA, I'm going to do it. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Derek. That's good stuff. Anything to add?
Well, I was going to bring it back to hiring. The only thing I'll add about the basketball piece is, you know, a lot of people thought this Warriors team would be bad. And there are a lot of people who don't think that having a very deep team is going to be effective. This is the media narrative at the moment, is like, this is a team that shouldn't be as successful as they seem to have been so far. But they're getting great production from their 8th, 9th, and 10th player. Not typical in the NBA, right? Okay, great. Or even their 11th, 12th, 13th player for that matter. You know, when I look at when I look at the team and see how they are winning, it is through aggressive defense. They're much better defensively than they were last year. And you could boil that down to a strategy that's basically like, okay, we have lots of people, which means that if we play more people, they will always be fresh. And if we have people who are always fresh, that means they should be able to run faster and be more aggressive and put more pressure on the other team's offense. And that is exactly what we're seeing with this team, right? It is it's a roster that lots of people think is talent deficient, but that is using a particular strength to overcome their weaknesses. And I think about companies in this way. So to draw it back to the business world, Superframe today is a 5-person company. 3 of us have children. And I personally believe, and my colleagues are on board with this too, that the most important thing in the world is your family. I care a lot about making SuperFrame successful, but I want to be there at dinner time for my kids. My dad worked really, really hard when I was young. He was always there at dinner time, and that is a thing that is, you know, sacred to me and that I try my best to do. I also don't believe that 40 hours a week is sufficient to be successful in a startup, right? Like, as I said before, our main tool to beat Salesforce is speed, and some of that speed just comes from working more. There's no other way around it. If you work more, in a lot of cases, you get more done. Now, how does that make us stack up to some Y Combinator company where everyone's like 23 and they don't have responsibilities and they have energy and they have a limited time and they don't care about anything and they just want to all live in the same house and hack all day? Well, we just have to figure out how we're going to use the tools that we have to outcompete that. And those tools are experience, and we can use that in the form of planning, in the form of like, hey, I know a lot of sales leaders already. I can just go talk to them and get the stuff directly. And so, you know, when I think about hiring, I think about, okay, well, how is someone going to fit into the system that we have right now? Like, yes, we could build a cohort of the hackery types that are just going to go and like blast through code really fast. But I think it would be tough to marry that type of group to the team that we already have that is thoughtful and focused and ultimately is achieving things on a timeline that I'm very happy with, but not by virtue of code 24/7. It's more like, hey, let's plan carefully and like think about how we're going to do this and just make fewer mistakes.
Know your edge, build your team that way. Last thing I'll say on the basketball note, you said not many people thought the Warriors were going to be good. I'm in a basketball wins league where you pick three teams. I had like the sixth pick. I got the Suns. I took the Warriors second. So that's why I'm following so closely. So I'm wishing you all a very regular season, a great regular season, except when you play the Phoenix Suns. Last hiring question for you. You're in the Valley. You've grown up in San Francisco. I'm sure you've seen some crazy things or interesting things or exciting things when it comes to interviews. When I ask you about a memorable interview, maybe somebody you were interviewing for your team or maybe an interview you were in early on in your career, anything come to mind?
Okay, I have a great one. This is I remember this perfectly, and it's from 2011 maybe, okay? So it was that good. So I used to work, before starting Mode, I worked at a company called Yammer, which was a real Silicon Valley success story. The way we got connected was through my former boss from Yammer, Peter Fishman, who's, you know, became the CEO of Mozart Data after a number of other jobs. Yep. He was really big on brain teaser interviews. And particularly, this was for the analytics team. You know, the thing that he wanted to do was filter out people based on essentially like intellectual horsepower right at the beginning. And so the first question that we used to give, it was standardized across the whole team, is we would run this brain teaser that was like, essentially tell me the expected value of rolling a dice, right? So if I said like, I'm going to give you a die and you roll that and I'm going to pay you however many dollars as the number that comes up. So if you roll a three, I pay you $3. How much money do you expect to make when you roll the dice? And the answer, you know, from rolling it one time is 3.5. It's just a simple average of the numbers on the die. Then there are follow-up questions that make it a little bit more difficult. We change the game to allow you to roll, pick up your dice and roll multiple times. And there's just like a very specific sort of statistical logical progression that you should go through. And Fish really liked that style of interviewing. One person, when we asked, how much do you expect to make when you roll the dice? Answered 6. And so I said, okay, like, you expect to make $6, like why is that? And his answer was, I'm just the kind of guy who rolls sixes. And I like,
he's a winner. Did you hire him?
No. For an analytics team, this is a terrible answer. And and like, you know, we like made fun of this guy internally. Like this was like, the team considered this to be the all-time worst answer to this question. It was so bad. With more experience, I have come to understand that this is actually an all-time great answer to this question, just not for the analytics team. Like, Send that guy to the
sales team. You want the guy who thinks he's rolling sixes every time,
100%,
right?
100%. That's a sales answer. So we should have just like funneled him to the appropriate place. But that one stands out to me as
great
the most
story. All right, everybody. If you get that question, the answer is 3.5. Derek here is helping you out. if you're interviewing a Mozart data, which we both know well, and we use Mozart in my company, that might be on the interview schedule with a good old Pete Fishman. So
I think it's unlikely. I think that one, they put that one on the pasture. Yeah.
I'll check in with Fish. I'm going to ask him. I might send him an email just asking him the exact question. We're going to go to our speed round in a second, but what's some advice that you would give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now?
I think it would probably have something to do with patience. Okay. I'm not a very patient person, which serves me well in some business contexts.
Sure.
But what I really mean is like patience with my, like on a moment by moment basis within myself. And this is the thing that having kids really teaches you, because you know, no one tests your patience like a, you know, 3, 4, or 5-year-old. I've come to understand, or at least this is a belief that I really hold now, most business disagreements, and this is like, you know, any flavor of interpersonal disagreement, but in particular, I'm thinking of like, hey, here's a problem, and one person thinks we should do this, and the other person thinks we should do the other thing. I really believe that those differing opinions, for the most part, stem from different information, like, do we think we're solving the same problem? Do we both understand the context of the problem? Have we both done the same research, or do we know the background of this problem? All of those things go into it. And so, you know, the particular flavor of patience that I'm thinking of is most of the time, I think the right answer in a lot of business cases is sit down, go back to basics, understand what the priors are, and then try to align on, are we solving the same problem before you go any further? And it just saves so much time, so much anxiety for so many people. This is true in hiring too. Are we hiring the right person? Do we know what we want? Can we go back? Right. I'm sure that everyone who has sat in on an interview panel and done a debrief where you're in a room talking about a candidate with other folks, like this is problem number one, is are we all talking about the same stuff? Do we care about the same stuff here? Like, that's the flavor of patience, is the patience to go back and make sure that we're all talking about the same thing before jump into the conclusion. I think that's what I would teach myself.
Yeah, listen, I just gotta say it because it's relevant. Like, that's one of the, like, what we did with our software, and our software is around creating a better experience for candidates and hiring managers and creating more certainty in hiring. And one of the big ones is, you know, why do things fall apart in hiring? Why do we not get the right person? Why do we hire somebody and 2 months later realize it was the wrong person? A big one is that lack of alignment, that definition of great and success among the interviewing team. And then the subsequent biases that everybody might have. Getting that kind of clarity and transparency across the board, and make sure you're all talking from the same context. You might have that collaboration meeting and be talking in your best intent, but also be talking past each other and totally missing the point on things. So that is a big area where people miss. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it is a patience thing. It is a thing that comes with maturity. I want people to get to know the person. We've learned a lot about the business. So I'm going to go through a speed round here. I'm going to ask you some questions. Just tell me what comes to mind when I ask. So the first one I'm going to ask is, I don't want to make any assumptions, but sounds like you had a really great exit at Mode. And I'm just interested to take people behind the mindset of an entrepreneur. I have to imagine that if you didn't want to, you could have relaxed, you could have been in chill mode like we talked about a little bit earlier, but you're driven to do something else. What is that? What is that about you? Is that something that you knew was going to happen? Was that a moment you woke up in the morning and you did it, or was that something you were pursuing as soon as you left Mode?
You know, Mode was, I think, by most people's standards, a good exit. I think it underachieved the potential of the company. And I can map back to certain things where, you know, decisions that we could have made differently that have, you know, would have been better even as early as like the founding days of the company. And a big part of my drive is, you know, for the sake of myself, but also, I'm a little bit motivated by, you know, what the world has to say. I would really like to hit the mark that I think we could have at Mode.
And you're taking the lessons that you learned from the first one, and you want to make the same mistakes and apply them to meet that potential with SuperFrame, correct?
Right, which is part of the reason that I'm comfortable with, you know, living in a very competitive market and doing essentially a home run swing. You know, a home run is the thing that I need to clear the last one, and that's okay. And I think, you know, with that knowledge of the market that I was in and everything, I think, you know, I feel pretty good about swinging for the fences with this idea in particular. I it doesn't actually feel that risky to me, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Love that.
I also think, you know, the type of people who start businesses, like I've been fortunate enough to meet some of the most successful, wealthiest people who could do nothing and then still work all the time. I think the reality is that the people who are successful tend to be successful because they like it. You know, the only folks that I've met who like make a bunch of money and then retire are the folks who kind of lucked into it. Like I've got a really close friend whose grandfather made a fortune selling metal toilets to prisons when that was novel, you know, back when they were all porcelain and inmates would like break them and stab each other. So, you know, he just had the right idea, right place, right time, made a ton of money. And, you know, he was a plumber. It's not like he was drawn to the intellectual pursuit of plumbing. You know, he was happy to go drive Ferraris for the rest of his life and did quite a bit of that. So, you know, I think it's also just, it's just ingrained, right?
I think the thing about people in our space is that your professional success or lack thereof, or whatever, it becomes part of your identity. And so when you don't have that anymore, you lose part of your identity, and that's not good for anybody. And so that purpose is what drives you and what keeps you going. And I've always said, like, I don't know what the heck I would do if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, but I'd be doing something. I'm not somebody that's going to be out on a boat or golfing all the time. I can promise you that.
Yeah, I think it is partially identity, but what I'm saying is it's also love of the game. You know, like the people who are successful in this world tend to be successful because they love doing the thing day to day, which I do. And, you know, that's not true of the plumber, but most of the people I know who work in tech are excited about the next big idea. They're in tech because they love technology and they love to move things forward.
Is there a tech CEO that you think most parallels your leadership style? Is there anybody that you could, like, that we might know of that you think of when I ask you that?
Man, oh, that is really difficult. I could tell you, like, the leader with whom I was most impressed was Mark Zuckerberg, like, of the companies that I've worked at. I was at Facebook very briefly in, like, 2010, 2011.
Well, we got to hear this. Why?
Well, look, I don't have tons to say other than he's – at that time, he was a much less practiced communicator than he is today. And I think he's always gotten a lot of flack in the media for the way that he communicates. But it always felt earnest and sincere. And I always got the impression that he was in it, again, for the not just the love of the game, but the love of, like, humanity. You know, you're asking me if, you know, why I don't, like, go retire to an island or something. Like, that's a guy who could have done that long, long, long ago. And yet he wants to push the boundary of what's possible because he truly cares about it. And so, you know, it always seemed odd to me that, you know, in times when Facebook was really under a microscope for, you know, data breach issues and things like that, the Cambridge Analytica is really what I'm thinking of at the moment. But, you know, some of these really high profile times where he was going and testifying, you know, he was so good at kind of anchoring everyone in the business on his vision and his humanity that I think a lot of the people who worked there, especially at that time, would, like, never had a doubt about his intentions or motivations behind the business. It was not about making money for Mark. I don't think that it is still. And so that, I think the number one thing that I take away from that is I want to lead in a way where people always understand what is going on in my mind. I want them to know why I'm making certain decisions, what I care about at the end of the day, and, you know, how I've thought through the next step, two steps, three steps. And if they know that, I think that they'll also understand a lot more things, or they won't need to ask the questions, right? Like, someday we might have to lay people off. And when that time comes, Which this is on all companies, right? Like even the most successful companies, you eventually at some point you lay some people off. So that will come. And when that comes, I want people to think Derek thought through this to the best of his ability. He made it clear why, and I agreed with him at the time. I would have made the same decisions in Derek's shoes. And therefore, I understand this to be the right business decision, painful as it is. And we're going to continue forward, right? Like, that's stuff that it just buys you the credibility and the kind of, you know, extra bit of power that you need to get through some of the really hard things about startup life.
Yeah, two things I'll say to that. So one is I was listening to Lenny's podcast the other day, and he had the head of product from Meta, who she was like employee number 19. And she said something similar to what you said. Even though Mark Zuckerberg has gone through this kind of PR reformation of like, he's like so swaggy cool now.
I know.
That wasn't the case 10 years ago. No. She said that he's always been this guy. He's probably the most misunderstood person I knew. And I knew him from very early on. And so that's that when you, it resonates when you talk about the authenticity. It's like, it's that his values, his vision and all that hasn't changed. Maybe just the way that we consume him and we take it in has changed. So I found that to be super, super interesting. And to your point, one of the things we talk about here at our company is that, you know, because we care deeply about our employees, but at the end of the day, you have to do the right thing for the business, right? That is my job as a founder and a CEO. And ultimately, what I've come to is that you're not always going to make decisions that people like, but you have a choice in the way you go about it. And if you do it the right way and you do it with humanity and you do things in a way that how you would want to be treated, then that's the best you can do, right? And that's something that I think is really, really important. So every time I'm thinking about big decisions that are going to impact people's lives positively or negatively, I'm putting myself in their shoes and understanding if I have to do this, what is the best way to go about doing it? I want to ask you a couple more Warriors ones, and then we got to wrap up. So let's go here. Who's your favorite non-Steph Warrior of all time?
Gary Payton. Ooh, all time? On the current team, it's Gary Payton the second because he's a major hustle guy. I'd have to think about all time. Non-Steph Warrior. Ooh. Baron Davis. I rewatched the clip of Baron Davis dunking on Kirilenko. He wasn't even a Warrior for that long, but that We Believe team was so special.
Was that your favorite team outside of the current dynasty? The We Believe team? Or
yeah.
Run TMC or what?
I'm a little too young for Run TMC. And we were not a basketball household when I was growing up, so I had to come to it a little bit later. But Baron Davis, definitely. That's like formative basketball memories for me.
All right, last question. You enjoy games more in Oakland or at the Oracle?
Ooh, it's gotta be Oakland, unfortunately. Chase Center is great, and I'll probably go to 20 games this year at Chase Center. I'm a big fan, and actually, I'm really excited about. So I have two daughters. I'm really excited about the Valkyries, their WNBA team coming.
Yeah,
so
I saw the new team. Looks really cool. I love the logo and everything.
Yeah, we are as of like a month ago, Valkyrie season ticket holders. I don't even know. They don't even have a roster yet. So we will be enthusiastic Valkyries fans in our household. I just want to go. I'm very intrigued by the Clipper Stadium where they have the kind of fan wall behind. Down.
Yeah, I mean, it looks fantastic. The wall, the screens they have, the t-shirt shooting. I want to go check it out too. This is the first time like it's a stadium that's like making me want to go to LA to go check it out and see how awesome it is.
I will do that at some point this year or next. But yeah, it's the wall for me. It's like the fan cheering section. You just want to be where the noise and the kind of maniac fans are. Oakland was just more like that than Chase. I think everyone would agree.
I think Steve Ballmer did a wonderful job with that. He was more focused on the fan experience than the money. I give him a ton of credit for that. Helps when you've got, you know, $8-10 billion. Listen, Derek, we're going to wrap up. I'm going to say one more thing. You got Steve Kerr and Andre Iguodala, two of my University of Arizona alums, Bear Down, on your team. So, again, I'm wishing you luck. I'm wishing you all the best with Superframe as well. I really appreciate you coming on, man. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Oz. It was fun.
All right. Talk to you later.